This is Fresh Air. I'm David Bianculli, professor of television studies at Rowan University in New Jersey, sitting in for Terry Gross. Today, we're going to listen back to Terry's 2020 interview with Mindy Kaling. She co-created and is the main writer of the Netflix series called Never Have I Ever, which draws on her own experiences when she was in high school. It was described in Vanity Fair as breezy and delightful, practically built for quarantine marathon watching. Season 2 begins next week. Kaling first became known for her role in NBC's The Office as Kelly Kapoor. She also was one of that show's writers and producers. She was an executive producer and star of the series The Mindy Project, and she wrote last year's comedy movie Late Night, in which she starred as the diversity hire in the writer's room of a late-night TV show. Let's start with a scene from the first season of Never Have I Ever. The main character, Devi, is the daughter of immigrants from India. The family lives in L.A., and Devi has just started her sophomore year of high school. She's one of the top students, but is considered nerdy and unpopular and literally prays for a boyfriend. Her freshman year was a disaster. Her father died of a heart attack while attending a classical music recital in which she was performing. Soon after, her legs became suddenly and mysteriously paralyzed, and she had to use a wheelchair, which didn't help her status at school. The paralysis ended as swiftly and mysteriously as it had begun. In this scene from episode 4, Devi is introducing herself to a college counselor who's married to one of her mother's friends. The counselor specializes in helping students get into Ivy League schools, the kind of school Devi is striving for. The voiceover you'll hear briefly is from John McEnroe, who narrates Devi's story. Devi is played by Maitreyi Ramakrishnan.
I just wanted to say how interested I would be in procuring your services. Your stats are amazing.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I only got 28 kids into Ivy's last year, but I wanted 30. The other two went to MIT, but you can't win them all.
Well, I guess I can't relate because I do win them all. I'm in all AP classes and got a perfect score on my PSAT.
Great segue, Devi. Effortless.
All while volunteering at the Kidney Dialysis Center. When I'm not doing that, I read Vietnam Vets, their Bill O'Reilly books.
Okay, look, I can say this because I married an Indian woman and am a proud member of this vibrant community, but schools don't want another Indian tryhard who is president of the Padded Resume Club.
What? Renal failure is what keeps me up at night.
Colleges want kids with unusual stories. I had this kid. He got into a car crash. He was dead a full 30 seconds. He said God told him to go to Yale. It worked.
I outgrew a nut allergy, so that's something.
I actually know who you are.
You do?
You're the girl whose dad died in front of her at a concert and became paralyzed.
Devi couldn't believe that the major trauma of her life could be reduced to a single sentence, but there it was.
Yeah? What about it?
That story is freaking amazing. You have the golden ticket. If you're willing to talk about it, I bet I can get you an in school you want.
But Devi didn't want to use the story of her father's death as a way to make herself more interesting to a bunch of admission committees.
No, I'm not gonna do that.
Well, without it, I don't get your angle. And to be honest, I don't see how you would be different than any other Indian kid applying to college.
I'm not like any other Indian kid, and I'm not interesting just because my dad died.
Then what makes you interesting?
Oh, I don't know, Ron. Maybe it's my perfect grades or my killer test scores. Or maybe it's my bitchin' personality or my insane PowerPoint skills. I don't need some washed-up white dude who leases a Tesla telling me what makes me special.
Leasing is still a financial commitment, and my monthly payment is quite high.
Mindy Kaling, welcome back to Fresh Air. Congratulations on your new series. Why did you want to create a series where the main character is a sophomore in high school? Was that a turning point year for you?
So the story of why we did the show is a little bit unromantic in that I was approached by Netflix by an executive named Brooke Kessler who had read both of my books and loved the sections about when I was a teenager. And those are pretty short sections because, like a lot of comedy writers, I think of my adolescence and childhood as incredibly embarrassing and painful. But she liked those sections and she had seen that I had not dramatized them. And so she wanted to know if I would ever consider that, and she thought I'd be a good fit for Netflix because there had never been a show about an Indian American girl on TV. And at first, I thought it would honestly be too painful and embarrassing to relive those experiences. And it ended up being very cathartic because I hired a staff of many young Indian women. And we talked about our teenage years, which all happened at different times, obviously, because I'm older than most of the staff. They're all in their 20s because we wanted to get a young perspective. And it made me feel that all the stuff I was going through as a teenager, I was like not alone. 15 is a good year, I think, to start a show because it's when you think you can handle things like sex and relationships and going off to college, but you really can't. And having a character with a big ego who thinks she knows what her life has in store for her, we just felt like that was a good year. Also, we had enough of high school left that we could dramatize the show for years to come.
Oh, I see, because she's a sophomore now. There could be the second semester, and two semesters of being a junior and then senior.
Yes, we have 30 years at least to do the show.
Right, she could go to college afterwards, yeah.
Exactly.
So in the
grad school, we see her give... Yes, go ahead.
Right. In the series, her father has a heart attack while attending a concert she's performing in, and he dies, and that's incredibly traumatic, and then you're the main character has this mysterious leg paralysis that lasts for, I don't know, a few weeks or a few months. Where did that storyline come from? I nothing like that happened to you, did it?
No, it didn't happen to me. It happened to the brother of my co-creator, Lang Fisher. So when we were talking about the series, there's so many teenage series on Netflix and actually just out there about love and sex and all of that. And we were both really interested because we had parents that died unexpectedly and talking about grief and how grief manifests itself. And her brother, after her parents got divorced, had about 4 months when his legs were paralyzed. And then all of a sudden they started working again. And they went to every doctor and they went to every psychologist, and it was this mysterious thing. And then when that happened, in researching it, this is something that happens to people, particularly young people, sometimes after trauma. So that was hard to resist as something to talk about. And after she spoke to her brother and got permission, we felt we wanted to use it in the series because we thought it was a really fascinating physical manifestation of a teenager's grief.
So, you know, you mentioned that you and your co-creator both lost parents unexpectedly. Your mother died in around 2011 of pancreatic cancer. Like, what are some of the ways her death informed how you wrote the series?
And actually a lot of unexpected ways. Lang and I and other writers who'd lost parents got to speak about that grief and unique circumstances that we thought were only us. Like we found that between the two of us and another writer, there were these instances after our parents died that we would have dreams about them where they were alive. And in the dreams, we would ourselves say, wait, you're dead. How are you talking to me? And they said, no, I got better. And so when you talk to two other people in a comedy writer's room, and they've all had this eerie, similar experience post their parents' death, it is, first of all, strange because we're in a comedy writer's room and it's not funny at all. But also like, wow, okay, well, this might be happening to other people as well. So those are things that we put in the script as well, is dreaming about your parents. And also the peculiar way that your relationship with your parent exists even after they've died. And that's something I've talked to a lot of people, that they feel that way, spiritual or not spiritual, you know, atheist or not. A lot of people have that same experience. And so we wanted to put that in the show too.
So the main character has two best friends. One of them is Chinese American, one of them's African American. The main character is Indian American. And so they're known as the UN. And she assumes that means United Nations, you know. But she is also told it's for a much more negative reason, because they're all uneffable. So were you called anything like that when you were in high school?
You know, I'm sure I was. I never discovered it to my face. I'm absolutely sure there was tons of mean nicknames for me, because I would hear mean nicknames about other nerdy girls who were not me. And you know, there was a tall girl who I went to school with who was very beautiful, actually, but she was tall, and because all the boys were shorter than her and that made them insecure, they called her Bista, and she had no idea that was her nickname. And so when you hear about things like that, I mean, that's such a cruel nickname. we just thought these girls have to have this. And, you know, that's been a real reflection of me in high school and my friend Lang as well, where we were nerds and I'm Asian. So we were just gravitated. I don't know whether it was comfort. We gravitated towards other minority nerds. And it wasn't something I'd seen on TV before. I thought, well, you know, this was my real experience, so maybe we should show it.
Were you a serious student like the main character is?
It's funny you ask that because I was a serious student, but one thing we noticed when we see shows about nerds is that because they tend to be a lot of the side characters, they tend to be very demure and wallflowers. They don't want to speak up for themselves. And that's definitely a kind of nerd that was at my school. But there's also like the belligerent, confident nerd. They want big things for themselves. And even though they're not getting it, it doesn't mean that they don't think they deserve it. And Lang, who is also an overachieving nerd who then went to an Ivy League school, we both had this same experience. And we wanted to show an ambitious nerd socially, wanted to lose her virginity, wanted to be cool, go to concerts. And it, of course, never happened for either of us. But we thought that would be fun to show. You know, they're not all sad, quiet bookworms, although we were also those things, but we were like loud and rambunctious and opinionated.
Were you belligerent?
I think at times. I think that when you are interested in comedy at a young age and you don't know how to express it, I'm not sure belligerent is exactly the right word. I do think that I stood up for myself a lot. In a way that probably put people off, certainly boys. Yeah.
Did you have a temper like your character does?
Definitely, and I still have a temper now. And it's interesting being Asian because I think that you don't associate Asian women with having tempers. And so, but so many of us do, right? So but that's not the stereotype about us. So I was thrilled to do a show about a lot of short-fused Asian women. And to show that side of us.
Did you have boyfriends in high school? Because your main character literally prays for a boyfriend.
Thank you for even posing the question. Of course the answer is no. It's ridiculous you even asked the question, but it was very polite of you, I'll say. No, of course not, Terry.
What kind of boyfriend did you dream of?
What kind of boyfriend did I dream of? You know, there's so many different kinds. One was a kind of... There's this term we use in our writer's room. I think we started at the office called NBC Handsome, which is a kind of like Zach Braff, Adam Brody, a kind of like brown-haired, floppy-haired guy who is unsure of himself a little bit, but kind of confident and super quick and probably grew up in the tri-state area. So for me, that was who I thought was good-looking and attractive because I felt like they weren't like the cool blonde jock. This was like a sensitive guy who, you know, probably went to an East Coast liberal arts school and he could handle my Indianness. And that's kind of what I was drawn to. Maybe Jewish, you know, like that kind of thing. It was like, could handle the spicy Indian food without saying it was too hot or something.
So since we've established that you have a temper, has it ever gotten you into serious trouble? Or did you ever do something like so out of control that you were really ashamed afterwards?
There were a lot of times when it would flare up when I was at the office because that was when I was so green, too, that I didn't understand the hierarchical nature of a writer's room. And so, you know, I also had a big chip on my shoulder because I was, you know, at least the first year, the only woman. And for a while, the only minority, like, full-time writer that was there. And so it would flare up a lot. The good news is that my boss there and my mentor was this very forgiving guy, Greg Daniels. And I've talked about him before on your show. But he was someone who was the opposite. He's very methodical and kind and thoughtful. And I think he kind of thought it was his responsibility to be patient with me through those things. And that's actually something that now, when I have so many younger writers, many of whom are minorities or young women, like I have really been confronted with, okay, we have to kind of do what Greg did. Because my natural inclination is if someone is fighting with me and I'm their boss, is to quell it by screaming at them. But now I really try to remember what Greg did and try to replicate that as much as I can.
You know, in this series, the main character meets a friend who is now at Princeton, which is one of the places that your character would like to end up in after high school. And she tells him if she's at Princeton away from home, she'd become an atheist and eat burgers and have a white boyfriend. But her friend, who actually is at Princeton, says, well, he thought maybe he'd feel that way too, but he has a Native American roommate, which has made him think a lot more about his own Indian heritage. Did you go through an experience like that yourself?
Yeah, almost exactly. My best friend from college, one of my small group of friends, is Native from Montana. And when we got to college, I was not part of like the Indian Alliance group. It didn't occur to me to be part of that, but she became very big in the Native Americans like student coalition, and they would have powwows, and she lived in the NAD house, which is the Native American housing, and she was so proud to be Native, and she was so proud to share it with her friends. And I remember feeling really embarrassed about that because I didn't have that relationship with being Indian or Hindu. And we went to visit her in Montana and went to the reservation where she grew up. And she would very proudly say, you know, I grew up on the res. I can't wait for you to meet my friends that I grew up with. And I felt kind of ashamed. I thought, like, you know, why is she so proud of this? And Native Americans in this country have been through so much more than I think Indian Americans have. And she's so proud of it. Maybe that's the reason why, actually, that she was, is there's like a defiance in it. But I did not have that same relationship with being Indian. And I remember being really ashamed. And that's a moment that we put into the Ganesh Puja episode, is her wondering why she has that relationship with her faith and with her culture.
So we were talking about how you didn't have a boyfriend in high school, and your character so far is kind of striking out. did your parents have strict views about dating or sex when you were growing up? And how did their views compare to what you wanted and how you behaved?
Well, it's so funny you bring that up. I was talking about this the other day because it was a real paradox. We were told overtly that no one was allowed to date while they were in high school. Not that there was anybody knocking down my door or anything like that, but that was a real rule. Like, that was not allowed, to have a boyfriend. At the same time, my mother really wanted me to dress very femininely, get my eyebrows done. She was totally fine with us going to Sephora to buy makeup, doing my hair. In fact, that was very important to her. So it was interesting. She wanted me to be kind of conventionally attractive and girly. I would even say more so than other moms, but then also shut the door on any kind of me having any romantic possibilities in high school, which I thought was interesting.
How do you reconcile those two ideas, making you more feminine, as attractive as possible, but not wanting you to have intimate relationships with boys?
I think she wanted me to be perfect. So she wanted me to be beautiful, and for people to want to be friends with me, and for people to think I was attractive, but then also pristine and not having a physical relationship with a boy, which, let me underline, would never have happened anyway. But so that everybody would want to be my friend and think I was attractive and pretty, but also was just this very focused, hardworking kid who just wanted to go to college, get into a great school. And I think that is something that would have made her really proud. And I was 50% of that. So, you know, I was the hardworking kid who got good grades. I wasn't the other thing, but, you know, I tried.
Would you have gone against your parents' wishes about sex had you had the opportunity, which you've made it clear you didn't have?
Oh, in a heartbeat. Okay. In a heartbeat. If my picture of Adam Brody from 1994 had wanted me to go to become his steady girlfriend, I would have died to have had this, like, stealthy, deceit-filled romantic relationship with him while also taking AP classes. I mean, that was my dream, to have it all. But, you know, that did not happen.
Mindy Kaling. Season 2 of her Netflix series Never Have I Ever begins next week. Kaling also was a writer and producer on the NBC series The Office and played Kelly Kapoor. We'll hear more of her interview with Terry Gross after a break, and I'll review two Hulu documentaries featuring music from the 1960s. I'm David Bean Cooley, and this is Fresh Air.
Capitalism touches every part of our lives.
Capitalism is a giant force that I don't understand.
I feel that it's a very safe system.
I'm constantly in fear of losing my job.
It is our biggest success and our biggest failure.
On this special series from Throughline, Capitalism.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
Let's get back to Terry's interview with Mindy Kaling, recorded last year. Season 2 of her Netflix series Never Have I Ever premieres next week. Loosely based on her own high school experiences, it's about a sophomore in high school named Davy, whose parents are from India. Davy is one of the school's best students, but wishes she were one of the more popular. She's far from it. She's considered nerdy and unattractive. Kaling first became known for her role on NBC's The Office as Kelly Kapoor. She also was a writer and producer on that series. She also starred in the TV series The Mindy Project and in the comedy movie Late Night, playing the diversity hire in the writer's room of a late-night TV show.
When I interviewed you in 2012, you mentioned, and I don't remember what the context is, you mentioned that you're interested in the prejudices that minorities have against other minorities, and you thought that that was a really good comedy area. And you work that into your new series in that there's an Indian woman who decided not to get the arranged marriage she was supposed to have, and she married a Muslim man. And then they divorced, and none of the women in this particular Indian community want to talk with her because she had married a Muslim man. Is that an example of what you were talking about in terms of prejudices some minorities have about other minorities? Of course, in India...
Yeah.
In India, Hindus are not a minority, but in America, they are.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is definitely an example of that. I have seen firsthand the racism that Hindus feel towards Muslims because of, you know, it's weird to inherit a prejudice because of something that's based in India, you know, because I think it's about Kashmir issues and just the issues that take place in India, and then you're supposed to inherit them when you're here too. And so that character felt really true to my childhood and my life of a woman who had made a choice and then was shunned because of it.
And what do you find funny about those tensions?
I find it funny because to the average white American, we're probably the same.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this is like, to me, it's really a narcissism of small differences. To the average American person, looking at someone who is a dark-skinned Indian Hindu person and a dark-skinned Indian Muslim person, I don't think anyone thinks there's a big difference between me and Aziz Ansari. But his family, you know, he's, I think, atheist, but his family is Muslim, and his dad grew up in the same town my dad grew up in South India, but my dad's Hindu. So there's this, you know, this giant chasm for people who are Indian about our different families. But to the outside person, they're like, yeah, they're both Indian. Aziz and Mindy, are they related to each other? Probably. Like, so I think I find that comical.
So for you and Aziz Ansari, it's more of a bond than a difference.
Yes. Yeah, we've actually talked about it too. I think when he started on Parks and Rec and I had been on The Office, we got so many tweets where people said, oh, they should be together, they should date. And it was like, why? Because we're the only two Indian people on NBC. So I think it's funny when our communities try to find lots of different reasons why we're so, so different when, you know, a majority of probably this country thinks we're identical.
Yeah. So you ended up going to Dartmouth College. You got your degree in playwriting.
Mm-hmm.
And then you went to New York and started doing stand-up. What was the comedy scene like then? What year are we talking?
I moved just before 9/11. So this is fall of 2001 until 2004 is when I was in New York.
It's a frightening time to start a new life on your own in New York.
Yeah, you know, that experience, being there for that, it really, you know, because we weren't able to use the subway even. I mean, if that post 9/11 New York was, we didn't have jobs, so we would walk across the Brooklyn Bridge just after, and we'd walk to the Village. So we'd spend like, you know, an hour and a half walking from Brooklyn to different restaurants to try to get, you know, waitressing gigs. You know, I was 21. I don't know why I would think it felt normal, but I feel like everyone else my age is doing the same thing. So
when you started trying out comedy, stand-up comedy in New York. What was your material like?
I remember thinking, okay, I do not want to be pegged as like an ethnic comedian. I shortened my name because MCs for these comedy shows would have trouble pronouncing it, and then they'd make a joke about my last name.
What was your
name?
And
I never wanted to... my real name is Vera Mindy Chokalingam, and it's a South Indian name, and it's a long name. And as a performer, these comedians would just butcher it and then be like, oh, I don't know what it is, just this girl, Mindy. And so I would go do stand-up mics, and I already felt like a huge distance from the audience just as a new comedian, but then an even more distance because it had been made so clear that I was ethnic. And then, you know, when you do comedy, everyone from Albert Brooks, you know, Woody Allen, these are all comedians who changed their names. And I felt it was the easiest thing for me to do. And ultimately, it was really beneficial to do it. And it was something that I had like a lot of mixed feelings about, but my parents didn't mind. I talked to them about it, and then I ended up shortening it. And I have to say, and I say this like it's bittersweet, but I have to say it was such a help to my career to have a name that people could pronounce.
So you didn't want to do ethnic material. So what was your material like?
Really bad observational, like poor man's, like Jerry Seinfeld observations about New York and my life. It was honestly trying to be so many different things. I love Jerry Seinfeld, so I tried to do material like him. I love Sarah Silverman, so I did try to do material like her. And ultimately, you can't go into stand-up comedy trying to do someone else's act very poorly. So I gave up doing it. I think I only probably did stand-up for a year and a half. And even during then, it wasn't a concentrated time. I would go do open mics once every 2 weeks. If the real reason I did it was my only way to dip my toes into the waters of comedy that was free and accessible. Because you couldn't just be like, hey, I want to go write for Saturday Night Live. Can you just like have me come do it? And there wasn't, you know, programs in place to discover talent that, you know, didn't necessarily look like what they already had. So it was my only access was through stand-up because it was accessible and free.
We're listening to Terry's 2020 interview with Mindy Kaling. She co-created and is the main writer of the Netflix comedy series Never Have I Ever, which presents season 2 next week. More after a break. This is Fresh Air.
Hi, it's Terry Gross, inviting you to check out our new online archive, collecting 40 years of Fresh Air interviews and reviews. You can hear my interviews with people like David Bowie, Aretha Franklin, Johnny Cash, John Updike, Toni Morrison. Search for names you're interested in. Make a playlist for yourself or friends at freshairarchive.org. That's freshairarchive.org.
Let's get back to Terry's interview with Mindy Kaling. She co-created and is the main writer of the Netflix series Never Have I Ever. She got her start on the NBC series The Office, playing Kelly Kapoor. She also was a writer and producer on that series.
So last year you had a movie called Late Night, in which you played an aspiring comic who gets a job. Basically, she's the minority hire for a late night TV show, a Tonight Show kind of show that's been hosted for 30 years by a woman played by Emma Thompson. And Emma Thompson's character has become kind of out of touch with what people, especially younger people, find funny. She's very arrogant, but she's told by the executives that unless the show becomes more relevant and the ratings pick up, she's out. So to shake things up a little bit, she figures, okay, we'll do a minority hire. She hires you. It's not like she has any faith in you. It's kind of, it's like you're hired. And then you have to deal with, you know, an all-white male writer's room and a host who is pretty condescending. Were you a diversity hire when you started working on The Office?
Yes. Yes. Proud diversity hire.
And but do you think like that was a successful diversity hire? Like you were hired to add diversity. Diversity was needed, and you turned out to be exceptionally talented. So it was kind of, I mean, do you see that as a win for The Office and a win for you?
Definitely. I think the program was invaluable, and I think that NBC was at that time the only one of the major networks that was doing something like that. At the time, I didn't think so. At the time, I thought it was really humiliating, actually. Because the way that that works is a diversity hire is no cost to the show. So when you get hired and you're a minority and through the NBC diversity hiring program, you know that the NBC is paying the cost of your salary, not the show. So that's why the show is incentivized to hire minorities. And what ends up happening, there's this phenomenon that would happen there, is that a writer would get hired for a year, and then they only pay your salary the first year. So if you are going to continue on for a second year, they won't pay your salary anymore. So you'd have this phenomenon on these shows, because other networks started doing the same thing, where you would have a minority writer who was a staff writer, which is the entry-level writing job, and then the next year there'd be a different staff writer. Because to promote them, the show would have to take on the cost of the staff. So, and everybody knows that this is the case. So when you go into a show, you're... biggest sensitivity is that everyone thinks the only reason you were hired is because you were free, whereas everyone else had to pay like good money for them. And I don't know whether how much people were actually thinking about that or whether that was just in my head, but it was just one of these subtle ways that I felt that I was a little bit less than the other writers. But it's tricky, right? Because the program is incredible and it got me into the business and many other people who now have who have nice careers in Hollywood. Yeah, it's a complicated thing, and that's why I wrote the movie Late Night, because I wanted to talk about it.
The Office is having this huge resurgence now, this huge renaissance. I think it's on like three different channels, including Comedy Central. There's like marathons. And what impact is that having on you, seeing that series like not only be back on TV, but it's pretty popular?
You know, it's incredible. It's funny how many 14, 15-year-old kids will come up to me at the airport because they've binged it on Netflix and they've seen everything. I mean, I remember about 3 or 4 years ago, I got a call from one of my agents saying, hey, this young singer-songwriter would love to sample a section of one of your episodes. I think you wrote it and then your voice is in it as Kelly. Do you mind if they do it? She's like an LA-based indie singer-songwriter. And I said, yeah, sure, that's fine. And I just signed something. And it was Billie Eilish, and she wrote a song called My Strange Addiction, which is one of her big hits. And the song samples different parts of The Office because she loves the show so much. In fact, she would even say it's not love, it's like she's obsessed with the show. And I think she's seen the entire series from season 1 to season 9 all the way through like 4 or 5 times. And so she wrote this song about it, and I'm sampled in it, and I didn't understand who she was at the time. So it's had this real impact on this younger generation. It's been great because that's not a show that I think could be made now.
Why not?
I think there's just a heightened sensitivity now to viewers that wasn't there when the show came out. But it's strange, right? Because the show is more popular now than it was, I think, even than when we first, certainly the first season of the show where we really struggled. I think that network executives, the way that Michael Scott behaves and the kind of stuff that he says, I think they would have a real fear that there would be blogs and articles and petitions written against them. I remember in the first season of The Office, there was a joke where it's Diversity Day, where Michael is talking to a Mexican-American character named Oscar, and he says, you know, Oscar, you're Mexican. And Oscar says, yes, I'm a proud Mexican. And he says, well, is there a term you would like to use that's less offensive? And then he's like, then Mexican? And he's like, yes, there yeah. isn't anything offensive. And it's a very like iconic Michael Scott joke. But I can't see, you know, I'm creating shows now. I can't see that being okay with a lot of heads of studios and networks to have that kind of show. And the reason why that joke is funny, because this character is so sweetly bigoted, you know? And I think that'd be hard to reconcile now. Well, how can a character be so bigoted, but you still cheer for him and you still want him to become a better person? And I think there's so much fear now of a bad reaction from people that they don't want to take those kind of creative risks.
And do you think that that's a shame?
I do. I'm not offended by very much. But then again, I've also not been marginalized in a lot of ways that people are. So it's tricky. I grew up loving comedy. I give people the benefit of the doubt. So in general, I'm less offended. But at the same time, there are people who are, you know, I think I'm very lucky. But it's too bad because I do think the show is very funny. And I don't think, you know, having been there, I do not think it was made by people who are trying to be offensive or push forth, you know, bad agendas. So I do think it's too bad.
Yeah, well, the joke is about how clueless Michael is. It's not an insult against, you know, being Mexican. It's It's a joke about how Michael never gets it.
Right, but Michael is also the lead of the show and the person right. whose point of right. view we're often in, the one you hope finds love. And so I think that would maybe be problematic now. Whereas if he was a side character that was supposed to be like the racist guy, that would be a little bit easier to stomach, but he was the person in power. But, you know, I'm wrong. You know, I'm often surprised at what's on TV, and I just think that sometimes networks and studios underestimate what Americans can handle and how sophisticated they are with what they watch.
And it has fear that people will misinterpret a joke or, you know, be, like, very sensitive in a way that you hadn't expected. Has that been inhibiting your writing in any way?
That's such a good question. You know, there's so much in Never Have I Ever that could be construed as offensive, but because I think the lead is what people would call like a marginalized person, like a young Indian American girl, I think we're able to get away with stuff because of a certain powerlessness that demographic has in society, honestly. So I think it's easier for our character to lash out or her mother to say things that could potentially be offensive because it's like, okay, well, you know, they don't have a ton of power in this country right now. And in terms of other shows, I think with why I think studios and networks would be shy about doing that is, I think, honestly, getting canceled. Like, I'm not getting canceled, like, in terms of TV terms, but, like, cancel culture and litigation and fearing that we're going to be, you know, the network's going to be the next Woody Allen getting dropped by his book publisher, you know, like, for something that they did. So I do think there's a lot of fear about that stuff that was not there in 2004 when we started the show.
Mindy Kaling, it's just been a pleasure to talk with you.
Thanks, Terry. Thank you so much for having me. It was such a pleasure talking to you as usual.
Mindy Kaling recorded last year. Season 2 of her Netflix series Never Have I Ever premieres next week. Coming up, I'll review 2 Hulu documentaries featuring music from the 1960s. This is Fresh Air.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Sattva, the comfort company. Sattva was the first company to sell luxury mattresses online without the hassle or expense of traditional mattress stores, so Sattva customers have always paid about 50% less than retail. Visit SAATVA.com/NPR today, where NPR listeners save an additional $200. Sattva, the comfort company. This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc. Teladoc offers access to licensed therapists by phone or video to help those dealing with stress, anxiety, personal, or family issues. Teladoc is committed to quality, confidential therapy from the comfort of your home, available 7 days a week, matching members to therapists, counselors, and psychiatrists. Teladoc therapy is available through most insurance or employers, and individual plans are also available. Download the app or visit teladoc.com/freshair to get started today.
This is Fresh Air. I'm TV critic David Biancooley. The streaming service Hulu has 2 new documentaries this month looking back on music from the 60s. One is called Summer of Soul, a new film, also showing in theaters, presenting never-before-seen footage from a Summer of 1969 concert series in Harlem that some have called the Black Woodstock. The other is called McCartney 321, a 6-part series in which Paul McCartney talks to producer Rick Rubin, deconstructing many old recordings from his Beatles and early solo days. The new Hulu documentary, Summer of Soul, is the first film directed by Amir Thompson, who is better known as Questlove, the leader of The Roots. He and The Roots are the house band for Jimmy Fallon on The Tonight Show, but Questlove should give some serious thought to quitting his night job. His first movie is such a confident and intelligent and entertaining effort. He has to make more. Summer of Soul is a revelation, a record of a mostly forgotten summer music festival that was staged in 1969 over 6 weekends in Harlem's Mount Morris Park, since renamed Marcus Garvey Park. Admission was free, and the lineup that summer, the same summer as Woodstock, was amazingly eclectic. It included everyone from Stevie Wonder and the Fifth Dimension to B.B. King and Sly and the Family Stone, who electrified that audience in Harlem 2 months before doing the same at Woodstock, singing very funky songs about togetherness.
Together, together. There is a yellow one that can't accept
just showing these performances would be enough, because most of this footage hasn't been seen until now. But Questlove, as a director, puts his musical taste and timing to great use. When Pop Staples and the Staple Singers are performing the song It's Been a Change, Questlove intercuts each lyric with the sounds of another event happening that day, the moon landing, complete with chatter from the astronauts and commentary from CBS anchor Walter Cronkite.
Moon landing. We're go. Same time. We're go.
Come on now, let's blow this thing out.
875 feet.
Yeah.
That's looking good.
60 seconds. Lights on.
Some are pushing hard.
Drifting to the right a little.
Some are holding back.
Picking up some dust.
You know it's a shame.
30 seconds.
The way some people act.
30 feet, 2.5 down.
The president said.
Okay, engine stop.
We would overcome.
Tranquility base here.
We gotta keep pushing on.
The Eagle has landed.
The work is done.
Man on the moon.
It's been a change.
Oh, boy. What?
It's been a change.
And as the song continues to build, so does the context. As Cronkite hands off to a reporter covering the Harlem Festival itself, who interviews members of the audience.
Well, there was a large crowd gathered in Harlem this afternoon. For some of the reaction there, correspondent Bill Plant.
There are 40,000, perhaps 50,000 people at Mount Morris Park in Harlem, but they are not here watching the moon landing. They are here at the Soul Festival, part of the third annual Harlem Cultural Festival. And for many of them, this is far more relevant than the mission of Apollo 11. What's your feeling now that the astronauts have landed safely on the moon?
I think it's very important, but I don't think it's any more relevant than, you know, the Harlem Cultural Festival here. I think it's equal.
What are your thoughts?
As far as science goes and everybody that's involved with the moon landing and astronauts, it's beautiful, you know. Like me, I couldn't care less.
This means more to you than that.
Yeah, much more. Cash they wasted, as far as I'm concerned, in getting to the moon could have been used to feed poor black people in Harlem and all over the place, all over this country. So, like, you know, like, never mind the moon, let's get some of that cash in Harlem.
Summer of Soul, now streaming on Hulu, is a fascinating look back. So is McCartney 321, a six-part series that premieres on Hulu all at once on July 16th. Music producer Rick Rubin, who has done seminal work with Run DMC, Red Hot Chili Peppers, and Johnny Cash, runs McCartney's old master tapes through a mixing board, isolating separate tracks and asking lots of questions about inspiration, process, and creative choices. It's a deep dive into the music, some from McCartney's early solo albums and Wings, but mostly from his days with the Beatles. And even though McCartney has told most of these stories before, they're amplified here by clips from other sources, by the isolated audio tracks, and by McCartney's animated reactions.
With Penny Lane, I'd come into the studio, and the night before, I happened to be watching on television the Brandenburg Concertos by Bach.
Yeah.
I just kind of got it in the background almost, you know, I'm listening to it. And then there's a little trumpet, very high little trumpet that Bach uses.
Mm.
And I came in the next day, I said to George, I said, George, Martin,
yeah.
I said, what was that? He said, oh, that's a piccolo trumpet. What do you think about George? He knew all the best players.
Yeah.
From the classical orchestras. And there's a guy called David Mason, who was a really good player. And so we just booked him.
Yeah.
So we go in there, and we've done the track, and we're ready to put this. We've left room for a solo.
Yeah.
George and David sort of say, OK, so what do we want to play? And I go, And they go, oh, OK, hang on. And they're writing it down. So we were kind of making it up on the spot.
Yeah.
And so I went and put like an impossible high note. And David Mason turns to me and says, well, that's officially out of the range of the piccolo trumpet, even. And I kind of give him a look like, yeah, like, you can do it. You know, and he goes, okay. So he plays it. And it's, it haunted him for the rest of his life, you know. Yeah.
The flute's beautiful too.
Yeah, it's a mix of the two.
That's only one song and only one excerpt, but you get the idea. The stories about compositions not written by McCartney are just as good, especially John Lennon's Come Together and George Harrison's While My Guitar Gently Weeps. If you were around during the 60s or love the music from that era, you just have to watch and also listen to both McCartney 321 and Summer of Soul. Monday on Fresh Air, The Startup Wife. We talk with Tamima Anam. Her new witty novel is about a young married couple who create a platform using algorithms to customize ceremonies and rituals for people who aren't religious. The platform's success turns the husband into a messiah figure, even though it's the wife who created the idea and the coding. Tamima Anam was born in Bangladesh and has written fiction and nonfiction about the Bangladesh War, in which her father fought. I hope you'll join us. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham, with additional engineering support by Joyce Lieberman, Julian Hertzfeld, and Mike Villers. For Terry Gross, I'm David Bean Cooley.